that are just your size, treats to tickle your taste buds, and special friends like Daniel Tiger to touch your heart. When you're a grown-up, Idlewild is every bit as magical, every bit as memorable, every bit as fun. Idlewild and Soak Zone, because you love to see them smile. Save up to $19 on select days when you buy online at Idlewild.com.
Well, we got some showers and thunderstorms likely today, just about an 80% chance that we'll see some wet weather off and on throughout the day and evening. Sunshine tomorrow, sunny on Sunday. A high today just about 84, a low down to 63. Tomorrow's high near 76, and then Saturday night down to 53. On Sunday, we'll hit a high of 78. We currently have just about 75 right now in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Tier Bank Studios. News time, 12:30. Dave Malarkey's up next. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Friday edition of It's Your Turn. We've had an interesting week with interviews all over the ballpark. We've had some interesting open talk conversation, and that's what we're starting out with today, by the way. The phone number is 283-2525 for open talk, 283-2525. Looking forward, very much looking forward to the second segment of our program. We're going to be talking about the history of Saxonburg Borough. They've got big plans afoot to celebrate their 185th anniversary. Not this weekend, but next. It's next weekend, right? Yeah. We'll have a couple of guests with us to talk about it, including Fred Caesar. He's with the Saxonburg Historical and Restoration Commission. He's also the coordinator of the Celebration Committee. And we'll also be chatting with Clifford Zink, who is an author and who wrote the book The Roebling Legacy, on how John Roebling founded Saxonburg and then went on to invent wire rope. And you probably know that story. It led to the Brooklyn Bridge and suspension bridges all over the world. So a pretty rich history in Saxonburg, and we'll be talking about it in some detail and have details, of course, on the big party that's coming up next weekend, too, a little bit later on the program. But first of all, open talk. Phone number is 283-2525. Butler, the city of Butler, still reeling from the flash flooding of a couple of nights ago. And who saw that coming, huh? Yeah, well, nobody, actually. We did get a warning from the National Weather Service, but that was about 10 o'clock on, that would have been Wednesday night. Yeah. And by that time, it was almost upon us, you know. And it started to rain, and it just poured for an hour and a half, 2 hours, just torrential downpour. We got an estimated 3 inches of rain, and it just overwhelmed the capability of particularly Sullivan Run, which snakes its way through the west end of the city of Butler, and it also goes under several rather low bridges in the west end. And a lot of debris got washed down in addition to the tremendous amounts of water. We just had some really ugly flooding. And the damage figure has not yet been totaled up. They may have some preliminary estimates by Monday. They've got another emergency management meeting on Monday morning. But as for now, they're just trying to clean up, just like yesterday, with scrapers and shovels and hoses, trying to get the mud off streets, sidewalks, porches, in some cases out of garages, in some cases out of businesses that were flooded. Pretty amazing. I remembered that some time ago, and I wasn't quite sure when, One of the Butler County Historical Society calendars published a series of pictures of past floods in Butler. And I was able to find it. Actually, I couldn't remember when, so I just started going back through the calendars. I have all of them. They're wonderful resources, the pictures. And it actually wasn't too long ago. It was 2 years ago. It was in the 2015 calendar. In the month of June, they published photographs of some of the more serious floods. And they were all back in the 1950s and 60s. The pictures are pretty astonishing. I mean, yeah, we had it bad a couple of nights ago, but it used to be far worse. There are a couple of pictures of the old athletic field that it's just totally submerged. I mean, that is a huge expanse that's completely flooded. There's a shocking picture of Pillow Street. And maybe the most shocking of all, a picture of West Cunningham Street showing water halfway up the sides of buildings. Down in that area, the lowest area of the city of Butler. Pretty amazing. That was the flood of 1954. In the photograph, right in the middle of the photograph, there's a car. And the caption says, "The roof of a vehicle is barely visible." I couldn't even see it at first. And I had to, you know, take a real close-up look, and then there it is. Just barely see the roof of this car. It looks like it's pretty close to the intersection of Cunningham and Jefferson Street, you know, where they Y off down there. There's a gas station there. There was back in 1954 as well. That's pretty deep water. Just barely see the roof of that car. There were actually three gas stations at that intersection back in those days, which I didn't know. One is, well, let's see, one's a Pennzoil. One's an Amoco. I don't have any Amoco stations anymore, do we? And what's the other one? Oh, it's a Golf. Yeah, Golf station. Pretty amazing pictures. And once again, you got to tip your hat to the Butler County Historical Society for these wonderful pictorial calendars that they publish every year. Now, here's my question, because I was not around here then. One of the pictures is from 1950, another one is from 1954, one's from 1960. Does anybody know when the Army Corps of Engineers came in here and changed the course of the Conequenessing Creek? Because it's my understanding that that was one of the things that contributed to the flooding, when the Conequenessing Creek snaked through what we know as the island section of the West End. In fact, they called it the island because it was almost completely surrounded by the creek. And the Army Corps of Engineers came in and simply cut a new channel. And what had been kind of a peninsula or almost an island, it was no longer an island. We still call it that, of course, the island section, but the Conequenessing now runs straight down as it comes down around under the South Main Street Viaduct. It's just a straight, pretty much a straight shot from there down to the Armco property. So did the worst of this flooding occur before they changed the creek bed, before they moved the creek bed? I'm assuming that it did, because this the Conequenessing, which is the main creek, would have been right up in this area before they changed the course of it. Now, most of the flooding a couple of nights ago was Sullivan Run. Sullivan Run feeds into the Conequenessing at that very area, down just past the swinging bridge. So you can imagine with the Sullivan Run flooding, as it did the other night, and the Conequenessing flooding, which it did not do the other night, you would have had some really, really horrendous floods, and probably much more often than we have them today. Now, flooding in the West End has occurred, I mean, I can remember it a couple of times in the past, in my memory. So it's not totally out of the ordinary. I saw a National Weather Service guy mention that this was like a 100 or 200-year occurrence. Well, I'm sorry, the guy doesn't know his history. We've had flooding in the West End before, and certainly more recently than 200 years ago. It was definitely an unusual event in terms of the amount of rain that came down in a short period, an estimated 3 inches in somewhere between 1.5 and 2 hours. But there has been flooding in the West End before. And I can remember talking with, at least the past two mayors, Tom Donaldson, the current mayor, and Maggie Stock, the mayor beforehand, and they've been concerned about these bridges over Sullivan Run in the West End. And there are several streets that traverse Sullivan Run. West Penn Street has to cross it. West Brady Street crosses it. West Newcastle Street crosses it. And Cunningham Street, they all cross Sullivan Run. And the bridges are pretty close to the, they're not big bridges. And any time you get really high water with debris, it backs up, it gets caught in the bridge. And that's the most visible indication of that from this most recent flooding is up on Penn Street. I drove through there yesterday. And the water was at least 3 feet above the bridge. And you can see all kinds of debris and stuff caught in the chain link fencing there and actually all over the place in the stream bank. And the further downstream you went, the more of this debris you had and the more of this damming effect with whenever the debris, the logs and the branches and everything else get caught up under the bridge, and that contributes to the flooding. Now, they're in the process of replacing the bridges. And this began, I believe, was back in the administration of Mayor Maggie Stock. She was mayor for 8 years. That's quite a few years ago. But it's a slow process. They've replaced two of them. Last summer, they replaced the Cunningham Street Bridge over Sullivan Run. So that's brand new. And I don't know. I didn't go down and inspect any of this, but it didn't look like there was a whole lot of, it was flooding there, but I don't think there was a whole lot of debris. Upstream, the next bridge up is Newcastle Street Bridge. That one was replaced 2 years ago. That street was closed down almost all summer. They put a brand new bridge in there. There are two more further upstream, Brady Street and Penn Street. I don't know whether there's a timetable for replacing them or not. I know they'll have to be replaced. And they also did some work, and I don't know whether this was the state or the feds, the Army Corps of Engineers, or what, but they did some stream bank work up near the Penn Street Bridge, where they went in, and it must have been quite a project, because for some distance downstream from the bridge, they put in cement, concrete abutments, concrete stream banks. Now, it doesn't go the whole way down. I don't know how far down it goes. I can't see it from Penn Street. But either they didn't feel they needed to go the whole way down, or they didn't have enough money, or I don't know what the deal was. Mayor Donaldson has said yesterday at his news conference that, you know, the state needs to come in and do more work there, cleaning out Sullivan Run, letting the water flow more freely in times of rain. Sullivan Run begins, well, it comes down through and under the 422 bypass, and then it flows through Butler Memorial Park, and then eventually down through the West End and into the Conequenessing. Well, it was a mess, and we feel for the people who were affected, either their homes or their businesses. It's just a real mess, and the damage is going to be very high, and we feel for them. Hats off to the emergency responders, the Butler City firefighters, the American Red Cross. They're still here doing damage assessment and offering help. So hats off to them. And last I heard, the city fire department was still pumping out basements. I mean, there were just so many, they couldn't possibly do them all at once. So you have to get on a list to get your basement pumped. So hats off, because those individuals are working hard, fast as they can. 283-2525, it's Open Talk, 2 days now after the flooding. Hi, caller, this is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead, it's your turn.
Hi, Dave. Hi. That flooding in the West End goes back to the 50s, as you had mentioned, I, as a child, lived on the island. I lived on Shore Street, and the Conequenessing, as we say, Crick, was right across the street from us. And there were at least two occasions when our family had to evacuate because the water came up, covered Shore Street, came right up to the houses, and essentially the entire island was underwater because back then the Conequenessing Creek was located there between Cunningham Street and Shore Street, and it kind of looped around to create what's called the island.
Matter of fact, that's why if you look at a map today, and I had one of the newer employees here at the radio station ask me, he said, why is that called Shore Street? I said, it's because it used to be the shore of the creek before they moved the creek.
Yeah, we used to, my dad had a garden on the other side of Shore Street between Shore Street and the creek. And as kids, you know, we were 8 and 9 years old, we would go over and play under the bridge up there at Wayne Street and, you know, take our little trucks and road graders and play. It was kind of sandy and rocky. I don't know if that's the thing I'd want my kids to do nowadays, but we would do that. But there were times, like my dad would evacuate us to Meridian to live with my grandmother for 4 or 5 days, sometimes a little longer, I guess. But he took 8-millimeter home movies, and I can show you a movie of a Army, it's called a duck amphibious vehicle going down Shore Street, and people in boats on the island paddling their boats around. The water never got into the first floor of our house because it kind of sat up high, but the basement was always full, and I just remember pumps running and mud everywhere when we'd come back, and what a pain that must have been for our family, and I know it is now for these folks that are so devastated by this flooding.
So am I right in my, because I did not live here then, am I right in my supposition that the main reason for moving the creek, for changing the course of the Conequenessing, was to try to alleviate some of this flooding and just making it a straight shot instead of curving around the island?
Yeah, it was a flood control project. They widened the Conequenessing, and they essentially filled it in. If you go down where the farmer's market is today and the park that's between Cunningham and Shore, that's where the creek did go. And it really has improved. I mean, we don't have those kind of floods. I mean, this flood was a flood. It was bad. But it's not like the floods of the 1950s and probably back even into the 40s and 30s that we used to have. So the flood control projects that were done, I guess it was done in the early 60s, have been successful. But I believe that they probably need to go back and do a little bit more stream widening and control of the banks and make sure that there's no potential clog points. Because it looked like over there near Penn Street that clogged up under the at the bridge, and when the water can't flow, it backs up, and you have a terrible flood.
Yeah, it seemed to me that the worst of the flooding by far was along Sullivan Run, not so much the Conequenessing. But the Conequenessing isn't actually that close anymore to that area. It's you know, further down by the new emergency Butler Area Sewer Authority tanks. But Sullivan Run, it looks like it needs to be really widened and dredged and really cleaned out to prevent this kind of thing in the future.
Well, I'm sure that there's places, if you follow the Pittsburgh news, in the Pittsburgh area, in our area, and all over the country, where infrastructure spending could be done to help alleviate those kinds of problems. And, and that's a really good thing to spend money on. Provides jobs and creates safer, more healthy, better communities for residents. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we need to spend federal dollars on, and because that flood control projects of the 60s were done with federal dollars.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, they're talking about that in Washington. They'd like to spend money on infrastructure, but I don't seem to be getting anything done down there right now. So
no, nothing. Hey, can I leave you with one story?
Please.
Back in the late 70s, no, it must have been earlier than that, maybe mid-70s. My wife and I lived on Miller Street in the city, and I guess it's Miller Avenue now, but we had friends that lived over just off of Mercer Street. And I don't know if you're familiar with what used to be the Newth Awning Company property there. But
No, not familiar with that one.
Yeah, Sullivan Run actually has a tributary to it right in the area of Penn Street. There is a stream that comes from up the Alameda Park Valley. That water is a tributary, and we had heavy, heavy rain. And it was Jack McCain's Market, and then it became Red Cross. But this Newth building, it was Newth Awning Company, it's on the other side of Mercer Street, up about a block or so. And that stream, if you drive down there someday, I think you'll be fascinated to learn that that stream, that tributary, actually goes under this building. The building is built on top of the stream. And if you go down there, it's pretty easy to find. If you just follow where the stream comes down from Alameda, there's a little bridge, and then it just goes under the building. Well, these people had their, they were living in the apartment upstairs, and their car was parked right beside the stream, and we had one of these flooding events. Their car was washed into that stream and carried all the way down and lodged itself under the bridge at Penn and Miller. And that was a pretty good flooding event in the mid-70s that resulted in that kind of power from that water coming down from Alameda Park to move that car.
Yeah, all these little streams, these runs as we refer to them, and with Butler, you know, being at the bottom of a hill, they're all flowing into the same place. Gully, that valley that comes down where Alameda Park is built, there's a stream there. In fact, there was the swimming pool once. That stream was dammed up to create the original swimming pool there.
Yeah, there was actually, they could do boating in that pond that was up there, lake, I guess.
Same thing with Sullivan Run as it comes down through Memorial Park and then eventually into the Conequenessing. But all of these streams in times of high rain overflow. I mean, they're not constructed for that kind of water all at the same time, you know.
Yeah, I wonder if any of your listeners will remember when in Memorial Park there was a dam that blocked up Sullivan Run, and there was a small lake or pond in Memorial Park.
Wow.
I don't know if you remember that.
I never knew about that. No, that's interesting.
In Memorial Park at
one
time.
Wow. What, they'd use it for ice skating or something?
I don't know. Our family was down there and ride bikes or have a picnic and maybe fishing. I was pretty young at the time, so this would have been probably in the 1950s, again, I'm thinking. But, yeah, there was a little pond there.
The other thing that occurs to me as we chat, whenever they built the 422 bypass, they had to make allowances for all of these streams and runs because they all go underneath the bypass.
Yeah, they sure do.
You know, they must have big, big hollow tubes down there or something.
That's funny now you mention that, because I worked at Alameda Park the summer of 1967. That was when the county first had started to develop it as a park, and they hired a bunch of us high school, college kids to do summer work. And I know where the stream goes, and I'm trying to think of how it gets from the kind of north side of 422 to the south side, and I just can't really remember right now. I have to go check that out.
It must have some kind of pretty well-reinforced culvert, because there's a heck of a lot of dirt on top of that until you get up to the highway, you know?
Oh yeah, there absolutely is.
Yeah.
Well, now you've opened up a little mystery that I'm going to have to try to figure out. So
keep us posted. Thank you, my friend.
All right, bye-bye.
283-2525 is our number. That is kind of fascinating. And next time you're driving down the bypass, you go, there's two large valleys, almost gorges, that were filled in, and that's standard procedure when you're building a limited access highway, whether it's an interstate or in this case a 422 bypass. But they had to make allowances for those creeks, those streams, to run through the bottom somehow. 283-2525 is our number. 283-2525. Again, we feel for the people who suffered damage. I haven't heard of anybody being injured, and that's, you know, we can thank the good Lord for that, but my, the damage is ugly. It's really ugly. 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
My sister lived on Brady Street. Not Brady Street. Anyhow.
Yeah?
Jefferson. No, okay. Forget what street. But there was a three her house set 3 feet high from a bank in it. And when that flood came through, it came through with one foot below the floor, at least the first floor.
Wow.
That was...
Now, was this one of the floods of years ago?
Yes. That was the original flood back there.
What, 45
or somewhere in there.
Yeah, I'm sure they went back, until they changed the course of the Conequenessing Creek. I'm sure they got flooded, in that area of town on a fairly regular basis,
Right.
Yeah. Appreciate it. Was you anybody injured in your family when that happened, or just damage?
No, myself and the son flushed it all down the drain.
Wow.
The garbage in the washer and dryer had to be disposed of. And
hot water tank, probably furnace, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a mess, that's for sure, when it happens. Yeah. Thanks, my friend. Nice to talk with you. Thanks for taking the time to call us today.
All right. You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Sure. I grew up, I'm sure many of you know, in a river town up along the Allegheny River, Parker. And when I was a very young child, we used to get flooding there on a regular basis, not from rains, but from ice jams. Now, our home was a couple of hundred feet above the river. We were way up on the bluff. But when you were down next to the river, whether it was business or residence or industry, they just got flooded on a regular basis. And it is just, there's nothing quite like it. It is really ugly and dirty and smelly, and it's just a mess. I called Kinzu Dam, put an end to all that when they put the Kinzu Dam in. Hi, caller, this is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Okay, I think that's me.
Yes, hi. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hey, just to answer your question on that 422 bypass.
Yes.
I'll tell you exactly what's under there. It's a more than just a culvert, like a pipe.
Mm-hmm.
It's like almost like a tunnel, a mini tunnel. It's concrete. Because when I was a kid, we used to ride our dirt bikes from, well, we used to go from the northern part of 422 underneath into Alameda, because there was a whole bunch of trails in the Alameda area, which came out on Mercer Road, on top of Mercer Road near the bridge.
Uh-huh.
And we used to actually, we naturally had headlights on them. They were, street legal dirt bikes, but it was going in a big tunnel, and there was enough for two bikes side by side to go through it. You had to watch for rocks and everything. It wasn't a smooth surface, but that's what's underneath at least that part by Aubrey's golf course.
Wow. Well, I knew that I've never seen it. I've never been down in there, but it would have to be more than just a big steel pipe because of the tremendous weight that's on top of it.
Oh, yeah, it's actually a mini tunnel, just like you'd go through down in Pittsburgh, the Liberty Tubes or whatever. It's pretty cool. But, yeah, that run goes all the way up to Mercer Road, on Duffy Road, rather, where the sharp bend is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a house there that has those big boulders because everybody kept going through his house.
I know it is, yes.
So that's where that starts at, because I used to run that creek. I used to run a trap line there when I was a kid, like 13, 14 years old. And
I'm
very familiar with that area.
I'm going to check that out. I'm a big map guy. I'll tell you what, some people think I'm nuts in my family. You give me a map, and I can be occupied for a couple of hours. So I'm going to have to get out my topo maps and check that out, because I've never done it, kind of trace the source of those streams. Sullivan Run pops to mind. Now, that's different than the one you're talking about.
There's a couple little feeder streams there from the old Herald Farm, which actually where the new VA is. It comes from the west into that. Right down right where the bend is, that's where it actually crosses in there, and there's a little, not a reservoir, but like a dam in there.
And it's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with the Pennsylvania Stream Map. It's like advertised in sporting magazines, and I see them in the Horse Trader sometimes. It's the original Stream Map, where it's advertised.
I'm going to write that down and get myself a copy of it. Pennsylvania Stream Map, huh?
Yeah, it's really good. It's reproduced from the original. Some guy back before computers and everything else compiled this with survey info, and it's like a really, it's like the Bible of stream maps. You know, it's cool.
Hey, I appreciate it. I'm going to get one of those. I've got a scoot because my guests are arriving here for the next segment of the program. But thanks so much. This is very interesting, and I'd like to talk about this again with you sometime. So, don't be a stranger.
Okay, we'll
thanks.
See you then. Thanks.
Bye bye. We have to take a break. We're moving into the next segment of our program, and I've been waiting for some weeks now since we set this up. We're going to be talking about the history of Saxonburg Borough, the history of John Roebling. We have a couple of guests who are going to be joining us, and it's going to be really, really fun. So please stick around, and we'll meet our guests coming up on It's Your Turn here on WISR in just a couple of minutes. We'll be right back.
Are you looking for a new pharmacy after hearing news of Kmart closing? Celebrating 10 years of pharmacy care to the Butler community, locally owned Institute Hill Pharmacy can fill your prescriptions in just 10 minutes. We take all major insurance plans, stock a variety of over-the-counter medications, and pride ourselves on fast, friendly customer service. And we are excited to offer a $5 off coupon for any transferred prescription from Kmart customers. Some restrictions apply.
Check out Institute Hill Pharmacy on Facebook or stop by their location on East Jefferson Street.
Institute Hill Pharmacy. An old-fashioned pharmacy, just the way you remember.
Thompson Miller probably receives more calls about cremation than any other subject. So let me share with you what you need to know, what you need to think about concerning this sensitive subject. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler is often asked these points. Should you consider cremation for your loved one? Is it appropriate for your family? What's the appropriate funeral service? What's the cost? Good questions. Cremation offers three advantages: simplicity, convenience, and it's local. Thompson Miller's cremation services are right here in Butler at our own newly created facility. We assure you that your loved ones will never leave our care at any point in the process. Let's talk it over privately right here at Thompson Miller, or call us at 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or online at www.thompson-miller.com. Thompson Miller at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Welcome back, listeners. Great to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program on a Friday. We're going to be talking about local history, history of Saxonburg on the next segment of the program. And we're going to be talking about a major event that's coming up. Not this weekend, but next weekend to celebrate some of the heritage of Saxonburg. First of all, let's say hello to our guests. With us here in the studio right now is Fred Caesar. Fred is with the, Historical Commission down in Saxonburg, and he's also the coordinator of the Planning Committee for the celebration. Fred, good to see you again.
Hi, good seeing you, Dave.
Last time I saw you, I was in your town.
Yes, right. Now I'm in your town now.
We made a visit to Saxonburg. I guess it was the early part of last year whenever we were celebrating our 75th anniversary here at WISR. And we took, I think it was a month or so, and we went around to various towns and did a live broadcast. And one of our stops was in Saxonburg, and one of our guests when we were there was Fred Caesar. So nice to have you with us here in the studio. And we also have a guest with us by telephone, and that's Clifford Zink. Cliff, nice of you to join us as well.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave.
Clifford Zink is the author of a wonderful, gorgeous book, really, called The Roebling Legacy. And we're talking, of course, about John Roebling, who Clifford Zink was the founder of Saxonburg, right?
That's correct. And you can see on the back cover of the book, Dave, that one of the seven images is a photograph of a parade in Saxonburg, the one on the most to the right.
Yes, I see it right now, yeah.
And on the right side of the photograph is visible the house that John Roebling built.
Wow. That's the White House. You can see a picture of the portion of the White House there.
Yes.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. So this was a long time ago. Fred, this was about 185 years ago, I guess.
That's
right?
Correct. That's the reason why we're celebrating. It was in 1832 that John Roebling and his brother Carl immigrated to the United States from Mulhausen, Germany, and founded Saxonburg.
Mulhausen is now a sister city of Saxonburg.
That's correct. Right? And for the celebration, we have four members of the delegation coming from Mulhausen to be with us for the celebration.
Hmm. Have you been there? Have you visited Mulhausen?
No, I have not. There have been several trips for members of Saxonburg Council and others who have been there, but no, I haven't yet.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty much right smack in the middle of Germany. I mean, I don't know what the exact geographic center of Germany is, but I just looked it up on the map this morning to confirm why I thought I remembered that. And it's a little bit north of Frankfurt, south of Berlin. It's almost right in the middle of Germany.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah. Right. At that time when they left, it was part of Prussia, and they left that country to come to the United States.
That's right. We forget that Germany, as we now know it, is actually relatively recent. It was a whole bunch of baronies and regional mini-states. There was Saxony was one of them, for example. I'm assuming that Saxonburg at least partially got its name from Saxony.
That's correct.
But the Germany, unified Germany, is relatively recent, actually, in terms of history.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yeah. Well, Clifford Zink, what's your interest in this? Are you from this area? Did you hear about John Roebling and you were intrigued? How did you get started on the book, The Roebling Legacy?
Well, I was born in New York City, and so when you're in New York, you grow up with the Brooklyn Bridge looming as really the icon
yes.
of New York City.
Yes.
It is the icon today, and it was really the icon even back then. And so back in 1983, they were celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And that piqued my interest, and so I started to doing some research on the Brooklyn Bridge, but also on the company, the John A. Roebling Sons Company in Trenton, New Jersey, that Roebling founded in 1848. And pretty soon discovered there was a lot of great history that hadn't really been told yet. David McCullough did an excellent job telling the story of the Brooklyn Bridge in his book, The Great Bridge. But there was lots of other stories within the overall Roebling story that were really still very intriguing and worth bringing to light.
Today's David McCullough's birthday, by the way, coincidentally.
Yeah. Good for you.
I saw that in the almanac this morning.
Right.
I can add one thing. David McCullough has autographed a copy of The Great Bridge, and it will be auctioned off, part of the raffle and auction, the night of the dinner on July 15th. So he did send us an autographed copy of The Great Bridge for somebody to take home that night.
Well, before I get too much involved in the history, and I love to talk local history, there may be people who can't be with us for one reason or another the whole time we're going to be chatting, so let's go over some of the details of the celebration so people don't miss out on that. It is, in fact, Fred Caesar next weekend, right?
That's correct, July 15th. Mm-hmm. We invite everybody to become a honorary Saxonburger for the day. We will start in the morning with a parade on Main Street. You can start lining up 9 o'clock and get ready for a parade that will be a hometown parade. But we have it's a historical theme, and we also have a German theme to it, obviously, because of the roots in that. In the after the parade, we're going to turn the Main Street into a street party, one of our Mingles on Main type event. We'll have food vendors and other vendors along the street during the whole afternoon. Also during the afternoon, just to let people know, Clifford Zink will be autographing and talking about his book at the Butler County Library, Community Library on Main Street during the afternoon as well. Mm-hmm. Then that night, we're going to have a reception and dinner. We're selling tickets for that. We're about 75% sold out, where Clifford Zink will be our speaker. But I also should note that during the whole day, we're honored to have Kristen Roebling. He is the great-great-great-grandson of John Roebling.
Wow.
He and his family will be attending, and he will be in the parade. He'll be meeting with people during the afternoon, and then he'll be our guest at dinner that night.
Hmm. I should point out that Clifford Zink's book is... this is a wonderful, wonderful book. First of all, it's... 270 pages. So this is a richly detailed history. There are hundreds of photographs in here and drawings, and some of them in color, some of them in black and white. It's hardcover. It is it's a beautiful book. It is a beautiful book. Has this been published? It's available already, Clifford.
Yes. So it's available on Amazon, and it's also available at... If you Google the Roebling Legacy, a web page will come up, and you can also buy it there.
Mm-hmm. Have you visited Saxonburg previously, Clifford, in the course of your research for this book?
I have. I have been to Saxonburg several times, and I've been treated to the fine Saxonburg hospitality.
I can speak for that, because on a couple of occasions when representatives from the sister city have come to Saxonburg. I think the mayor of Mühlhausen was here a couple of times, and actually interviewed him and another individual for this program. He speaks very limited English. I speak even more limited German. It was like watching a United Nations news conference when we did that, did that interview. But we were all smiles. Everybody was all smiles. It was a good time.
The mayor is coming back. He will be here.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, he'll be here next weekend.
Wonderful. So this is going to be a real soiree then. I mean, this is going to be quite a day next Saturday.
It will be a big day. That's the reason why I say everybody come on to Saxonburg and enjoy the day. And you'll learn history at the same time. Mm-hmm. You'll have an opportunity. The museum, the Saxonburg Museum, will be open during the afternoon. And we also have the, next to the museum stands the wire rope workshop, where John Roebling did a lot of his design work and did some of his early crafting. And actually, and Clifford can add to some history about that, is that John Roebling, when he developed the patent, which was, and another reason why the anniversary is the 175th anniversary celebration. The 185th is the founding of Saxonburg. The 175th is on July 16th, 1842, 175 years ago. John Roebling received U.S. Patent 2720 for the wire rope process, which he invented while he was there in Saxonburg, and he made some of the first wire rope cables, stretching out about 2,500 feet of it, with about anywhere from 6 to 18 men helping him twist wire from an area in Saxonburg, and then he would spool it and take it to Freeport to put on the barges.
Hmm. Amazing. I want to talk with Clifford specifically about some of this engineering work, but just a couple of notes, if either of you know. Did Roebling, John Roebling, came with his brother. Did he have a family? Was he married? Did he have kids when he came here?
No, he married when he was here. He married the daughter of a tailor. What he did when he first came, he kept writing letters back to family and friends in Germany, talking about how nice this area was, good climate, and reasons to come. And so other friends, other family members came from Mühlhausen, and set up Saxonburg. Hmm. Morhoff's store that's now Curds and Molds was originally a Morhoff store. Morhoff family came over from and immigrated to him, and many of the others that established the commerce of the area were all brought over by John Roebling. He married the daughter of a tailor. He had six children while he was in Saxonburg. His eldest son was Colonel Washington Roebling, who was born in 1837, by the way, so it's another anniversary this year. But it also is a sad, 1837 also was a marking for a sad year. That was the year his brother died. Uh-huh. And Carl Roebling is buried at Saxonburg Cemetery. He is the only Roebling buried there, except for then Amelia Roebling Knock is also buried in the cemetery. And for the listeners and others to know, when Chris Roebling comes to town, he has graciously agreed to go visit the grave sites and put a wreath on those grave sites for to his relatives.
Wow. Clifford Zink, who's with us by telephone today, we appreciate that because sometimes that's a little awkward. And Cliff, before I forget, thanks a lot for making the effort to join us here today. So was Roebling, I mean, he invented wire rope. Was he an engineer when he came here from Germany? Had he, you know, had he undergone education? Did he go to college? Was he just a brilliant inventor and tinkerer on his own right, kind of like Benjamin Franklin, or what was the deal on that?
Well, John Roebling did not actually invent wire rope. You know, in the history of innovations, a lot of people develop something, and then many other people come after them and make improvements that turn the invention into a major product.
Mm-hmm.
And the most notable person in our lifetime who did that is Steve Jobs.
Okay.
Who, when he went to the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, called Xerox Park in California, the scientist there, when he was a young man, showed him a mouse, and they showed him an icon that appeared on a screen, and they had invented both of those. But they weren't really thinking very broadly about what to do with them. And so he took the idea of a mouse, and he took the idea of an icon, and he went back, and with his friend Steve Wozniak, they developed the first Mac computer, and it came out with a mouse, and it came out with these icons, and so they revolutionized the way people can interact with computers. But he didn't invent either of those. In the same way, John Roebling didn't invent wire rope. That, interestingly, the earliest known use of wire rope was, interestingly, back in Germany, in the same area where Roebling grew up, in the Harz Mountains. There was a German mining manager, and he was pulling ore out of a mine, and they were using hemp ropes like people used here in America.
Mm-hmm.
But the hemp is a vegetable fiber, and it's subject to rotting, and it's strong, but it also is fragile, and it also has a tendency to wear when it scrapes against something. So it was a big impediment to the hauling of rope, hauling of ore. So this German mining manager got the idea to take some wires, and he twisted them into a rope. But it was an extremely simple rope. But then he wrote an article about it in German. The article was published in English, probably first in England. The Franklin Institute in Philadelphia got hold of the article in English, and they published it in the Journal of the Franklin Institute. John Roebling in Saxenburg was a subscriber to the Journal of the Franklin Institute. And when his issue arrived, he read about this mining manager in his home country of Prussia developing something he called wire rope. And so when Roebling saw, when he was surveying for a railroad route across the Allegheny Mountains, he became familiar with the old portage system, the old portage railway, where a canal boat would come up to the foot of the mountain, and then it would slide across the top of a submerged railroad car, and then it would be lashed to the car, and then that car was hauled up to the top of the mountain with a steam engine at the top turning a big wheel. It was hauled up by wire rope and then let down the other side. As in the mines in Germany, the hemp rope used on these inclined planes was fragile and expensive. And so the light bulb went off in Roebling's head, and he got the idea, well, I can make a wire rope that should be better than this hemp rope. And so he improved on the invention like so many people do. And in his case, Roebling was very entrepreneurial in addition to being a trained engineer. And he went to the operator of the inclined plane and offered to make this rope at his own expense and to install it at his own expense. And if it worked, within a year, the mining or the inclined plane operator could pay him. And he installed it, the rope worked, and he got his first payment for wire rope.
Wow.
Then, being a really smart businessman, the next thing he did was started to market it. And so he wrote an article about his wire rope, and it was published in the American Railroad Journal. Now, today, nobody, and certainly I never had heard of the American Railroad Journal, but think of it a century and a half ago as the Wired magazine of its day.
Okay.
Most of the innovation that was taking place in railroads because they were being extended all across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were interested in technology, you got an issue of the American Railroad Journal. And so Roebling wrote an article about his wire rope in it, and pretty soon he got orders from other plane operators in other parts of Pennsylvania and New York, and then he was in the wire rope business in his backyard in Saxonburg. A really amazing American story. And to answer your question about his training, Roebling was extremely fortunate to have grown up at a time of great change in the early 19th century in Germany. And your listeners, Dave, who have gray hair like I do, will remember Sputnik back in 1957, another anniversary this year. When Sputnik came in, Americans were aghast that the Russians were going to be ahead of us in technology. And so what did we do? We increased science and math education. And in the year 1806, when Roebling was born in Prussia, Napoleon marched in and routed the Prussian army, and the king fled to Poland, and Napoleon triumphantly marched into Berlin, and the Russian monarchy realized that they were way behind the French in terms of technology, because in those days, technology had a lot to do with military, with artillery and also with bridge building for moving an army.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have to build temporary bridges. So anyway, the Prussian army upgraded its educational system, and young John Roebling, when he grew up in Prussia, was able to study more math and a little bit of science than he had if Napoleon hadn't marched in. And then Roebling won a place at the Royal Building Academy in Berlin in 1824, where he studied architecture and bridge engineering. And then when he emigrated to this country in 1831, there were almost no trained engineers in America. The first American engineering school opened in 1824, and that was RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And so Roebling came upon the American landscape in 1831, 25 years old, with probably one of the best engineering educations he could have gotten anywhere in the world. And he wound up in a very fortuitous place, being Western Pennsylvania, where there was a tremendous amount of need for technology. And so he was an example of what Walter Isaacson, who is Steve Jobs' biographer, Walter Isaacson wrote that innovation occurs where ripe seed falls on fertile ground. And 185 years ago, the ripe seed was the brilliant John Roebling with a great education, and the fertile ground was Saxonburg and that area of Western Pennsylvania.
Where did he get, so he twisted this rope right in Saxonburg. Where did the wire come from? Someplace in Pittsburgh? Is that where he got the wire?
Yes, there was already a fair amount of iron working going on in Pittsburgh. And he went down there and he bought some wire from somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And his son Washington, many, many decades later, wrote that he was very amazed that his father was able to make such a complex wire rope as his first wire rope. And it was very hard to do. They had to make it by hand, by stretching out the ropes. The research suggests that he did it on the back of his property. In those days, the lots, when they laid them out in Saxonburg, were laid out on the old European plan, where you had some frontage on the main road and a certain amount of width, but then your lot went back for very, very long distance. And so the research suggests that he hired other farmers, and they came and they stretched out the wires and twisted them by hand into rope. But it was quite a bit of just remarkable skill.
So it would be like almost braiding a young girl's hair on a monumental scale, I guess, and you're doing it by hand.
Well, I think when you're braiding a young girl's hair, there are other considerations. But, you know, he never saw a wire rope, which is interesting. He had to come up and make one. So that was really his great contribution to the modern age. Mm-hmm.
And not to get into too much technicalities with engineering, obviously when you have several strands of plain old wire and you twist them together, you increase the strength monumentally, right? It becomes much, much stronger.
That's true, and also it becomes more durable, because if you take a 1-inch diameter wire rope, it is made of many little pieces, and if one of those pieces fail, the rope still holds. If you take a 1-inch iron bar, and if that bar has an imperfection in it and it cracks, you lose the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. So, but on top of that, the brilliant aspect of wire rope, like any rope, is that it is flexible, and so you can turn it. And someone described wire rope one time as a gravity machine.
Hmm.
And if you think about it, almost all uses of wire rope are for doing something with gravity. Like a suspension bridge translates the weight of the steel and the cars on the bridge and translates it to the big cables, which carries that gravitational force up to the towers and pushes it down or transfers it to the towers and to the foundation. Mm-hmm. And certainly if you're pulling an elevator or a cable car, you're doing something with gravity.
Or a canal boat over a mountain.
Exactly. So it's a gravity machine, a flexible gravity machine.
We have to take a break. We're going to pick up our conversation. And by the way, just before we go to break, let me remind you that Clifford Zink's book, The Roebling Legacy, will be available for purchase at the event next Saturday, the 15th. And will you be available for possible book signings, Clifford?
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
At the library and also after the dinner.
Wonderful. We'll take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this marvelous history of John Roebling and the history of Saxonburg and the big celebration of the 185th anniversary 1 week from tomorrow, Saturday next. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR, and we'll be back right after these words. One of our sponsors on the program today is Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street, downtown Butler. Just bumped into Jimmy Chiprian a couple of days ago. He was here at the radio station. Miller's has been there for, well, they're going on 125 years now. Well, that's not quite as long as Saxonburg, but it's getting darn close. That's tradition for a merchant, 125 years. They are where you will find locally SAS Comfort Shoes. And they are, I guarantee you, they're the most comfortable shoes you will ever wear. They're also made in America, which is pretty rare these days for shoes. But not only will you find SAS shoes, they make sandals. for men and women. And they're just as comfortable as the shoes. They're like no other sandals. Variety of different styles, different colors, just like the shoes. They've got a great stock of them for men and women. SAS, comfort shoes and sandals, available locally at Miller's Shoes. They also have all your famous brands of athletic shoes, biggest selection in the area. They've got them all there. Nike, New Balance, Saucony, Rockport, Keds, Skechers, Easy Spirit, Asics, ProPet. There's no need to go to two or three or four different stores. They've got them all there. Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler, literally serving generations of folks around this area. Miller's Shoes. We'll be back after this.
A few years ago, I coined the phrase for Robert Stevens Jewelers, making beautiful memories on Main. I'd like to take that a step further and add, making your dreams come true on Main. You dream it up, and with Steve's creativity and 30 years behind the goldsmith bench, along with computer-aided drawings, he's going to make it happen. It's obvious. You can't fake experience. On Main Street in Butler, it's Robert Stevens Jewelers, taking dreams and making memories.
We are speaking today with physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist, Dr. Edward Reedy from Tri-Rivers Surgical. Dr. Reedy, what causes chronic neck pain?
Chronic neck pain is a very common disorder. In many studies, well over half the population will experience it at some point in their life. The most common cause far and away would be degenerative disease of the spine, which occurs in patients as early as in their 40s and 50s. Now, this is usually due to deterioration of the discs of the spine, which is essentially a form of arthritis. Other causes include disc herniations. Sometimes these are caused by auto accidents or lifting injuries or other trauma.
To learn more, call Tri-Rivers Surgical at their new office near the Clearview Mall in Butler. Toll free, 866-874-7483. That number again is 866-874-7483. Welcome back, folks. If you've just joined us, terrific. We still have a little bit of time to talk with our guests about Saxenburg, the history of Saxenburg, the legacy of John Roebling, the founder of Saxenburg, his tremendous work as an engineer and with wire rope, and also about a celebration event marking the 150th anniversary of the founding of Saxenburg, which is all going to take place a week from tomorrow. Everything is on Saturday, right, Fred?
Yes, there is one additional event on Sunday morning. The main church, the white church at the head of Main Street, the mm-hmm. Saxenburg, that church was designed and built by John Roebling.
Wow, what a guy. That's amazing.
He laid out the town, the streets, wow. and everything. I mean, he did it all. But we will have a Reverend Doug Dorsey of the church will have a service there, and Christian Roebling, the great-great-grandson, and the German delegation will be attending that service as well at 8 o'clock on Sunday morning. But the main event is on Saturday, and all are welcome to come that day.
And the parade and the street party and so on, there's no admission charge for that?
No admission charge. Just come, line up, and be there, and all of Main Street will be closed, and you can enjoy the iconic town that we have.
Now, one other mention. There will be a dinner reception at the museum Saturday night. Did you say there are still a few seats available for that?
There are tickets still available. You can go online to www.saxenburgbusiness.org, and you'll see a yellow tab, and click on that, and it'll take you where you can buy tickets. Mm-hmm. We're about 75% sold out. They all want to come here, Clifford Zink, and see Kristen Roebling, and so anyone else can still purchase tickets and join us.
That's Fred Caesar that we're talking to. He's on the Saxenburg Historical and Restoration Commission, and he's serving as coordinator of this 185th celebration event coming up a week from tomorrow. The keynote speaker at that reception dinner and the author of a really incredible big book called The Roebling Legacy, Clifford Zink, is with us as well today. He joins us by telephone. So just to pick up the story of Roebling, he improved upon this wire rope concept. He would manufacture it right there in Saxenburg. Did he eventually leave Saxenburg and go to some other part of the country to start building bridges? Or, Clifford, what was the deal on that?
Well, when I said earlier he had studied engineering and architecture at the Royal Building Academy in Berlin. He got very interested in a new type of bridge being built, suspension bridges. Now, suspension bridges themselves have been around, I think, about 6,000 years. And, you know, in China and certain parts of the world where very, very old evidence has been found of the use of, you know, stretching vegetable fibers across some river or ravine and having some planks and having a suspension bridge. So that wasn't new technology, but in the early 19th century, people were starting to make suspension bridges with iron bars, long iron bars with, like, eyelets at each end, and you would bolt them together. And some people in France were starting to make them with wire. And so Roebling read about this when he was in school, and he got very interested in this new technology, and he, like other people, realized that a suspension bridge could be longer than any other type of bridge. There's a limitation to how big you can build a stone arch, and there's a limitation in how big you can build a steel arch or a steel truss. But with a suspension bridge, you could make it much, much longer. And so he had actually, after studying at the Royal Building Academy, part of his education required him to work in the road department, repairing and building culverts and little bridges on roads. And so he proposed, in at least on two occasions, to build suspension bridges, small suspension bridges in Germany, but his proposals were turned down by the senior authorities in the road department, partly because the technology was new and they were worried about it, but also the system in those days was very hierarchical, and you weren't going to get to propose something new as a young engineer. You had to wait until you rose up in the ranks and reached a senior position of authority, because the older engineers did not want some young whippersnapper showing them something new that they didn't understand. So Roebling was thwarted by that, and that was one of the reasons he emigrated to America. Anyway, in 1844, he got the opportunity to build his first suspension bridge while he was living in Saxonburg. And there was a canal over the Allegheny River there was an aqueduct, a wooden aqueduct, that was a big truss aqueduct, just like a covered bridge, except it carried water instead of horses and carriages. And that aqueduct, being a wooden truss, was rotting and was getting about to fail. So the city of Pittsburgh put out a request for proposals, this was 1844, for somebody to come and replace the bridge. And that meant to design it and to build it, because in those days there weren't separate engineers and separate builders. Mostly there were master builders, master bridge builders, who would be able to build a complex bridge like this. Remember you asked me where Roebling got his wire rope, and I said in Pittsburgh?
Yeah.
Well, his wire rope supplier in Pittsburgh heard about this RFP. I don't know if they called it that in those days, but heard about this request for a proposal to replace the Allegheny Aqueduct, and wrote a letter to John Roebling saying, this could be the opportunity you have been waiting for.
Wow.
And so Roebling went there and came up with his proposal, and he built the bridge, and it was... That was completely an innovation on his part. Nobody had ever thought of a suspension aqueduct. And that was a big success.
So that was his first project. His next one, and by the way, there's a list of all of them in Clifford Zink's book, was the, I did a double take when I saw this, the Smithfield Street Bridge in Pittsburgh. However, it was the original Smithfield Street Bridge, not the one that exists right now, I guess, huh?
Not the one that's there now, but there was a fire that destroyed the Smithfield Street Bridge. And so while Roebling was building the Allegheny Aqueduct, he got a request to redo that bridge, and he did that. So that was the first vehicular bridge that he did with wire rope. And his son Washington, again many decades later, wrote that it was Roebling's experience in Saxonburg of having twisted those wires together to make his first rope that gave him an understanding of how wire rope actually works and how it could be used in a suspension bridge. Hmm. So John Roebling had the idea to build suspension bridges, but it was Washington, according to Washington, it was John's experience in Saxonburg making those first ropes that gave him the know-how.
Our time begins to run a little short, so I'm going to be truncating things here because there's just a few things I want to mention that people will be interested in. Roebling went on to design, looks to me like a total of 10 bridges, one of which, I never realized this, the Niagara Falls Suspension Bridge. Now, there's a project for you. Oh, we just want you to build a bridge over Niagara Falls. Pretty neat. But, of course, the most famous of all is the Brooklyn Bridge. But there's a story here that many people don't realize, Clifford, and that is that John Roebling designed the Brooklyn Bridge, but he didn't actually build it, did he?
No, so he was 61 when he designed it. In 1867 he designed it, and he had actually proposed a bridge across the East River 10 years earlier in 1857, and so he designed it, and the proposal was accepted. And then when he and his son Washington, who had joined him as assistant engineer, they were out surveying for the Brooklyn Tower by where the Fulton Ferry came in.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when a ferry boat comes into a slip, if there's a big wave, instead of coming straight in, the wave might move the ferry off to one side, and that's what happened. And John and his son Washington were standing by the pier, and the ferry boat got pushed by a wave, and it slammed into the pier. And Washington called to his father to jump out of the way, but he didn't move fast enough, and his foot got crushed. Now, John Roebling is an interesting man of many complexities, and he had very strong opinions, and one of his opinions was his belief in the water cure, which was popular in the 19th century. And according to the water cure, you could cure yourself either by taking baths of various types of mineral waters. And you know, there are all those baths in Europe, those famous mm-hmm. baths where people would go.
Yeah.
And even in the U.S. Or if you had some injury, you could cure it by bathing it constantly in water. People didn't quite understand how germs operate, how bacteria operates in those days. And so his doctor wanted to amputate his toes, but Roebling didn't want that, so he had his son Washington set up a drip system to drip water on his foot. And unfortunately, he got infected, and he got tetanus, and tetanus went into lockjaw, and he died 10 days after the accident.
But
he was kind of a little bit like, you know, in a small way, a little bit like Moses. He had brought the people to the promised land of building this great bridge joining the cities of Brooklyn and Manhattan, and that was a lot of work to convince people that this was feasible. But he didn't live to actually see it happen.
Just like Moses didn't get there either. But his son, Washington, did complete the project, right?
Yes, he did.
Yes, so Washington was 32, and he had helped his father complete the Cincinnati-Covington Suspension Bridge, which is still there. And by the way, It also is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. Mm. It opened in January 1867, and that was the precursor to the Brooklyn Bridge. And so the man who knew the second amount about suspension bridges in the entire world was Washington Roebling. And he was designated by the bridge authorities to become the chief engineer.
And he was born in Saxonburg.
And the bridge is still there and still being used. We have to take another break. We'll come back and chat just a bit more with our guests before we run out of time here on It's Your Turn Today. We'll be back right after these words.
It seems that almost every day there's news of a breakthrough in healthcare. New medicines and procedures. Imaging that opens a new window into the human body. At Butler Health System, interventional radiologist Dr. Thomas Franco understands that even with these breakthroughs, no technology can replace the human side of care.
Every image tells us a story, but there's a bigger picture, and we never lose sight of that. Healthcare is more than practicing medicine. It's about taking the time to understand where every patient is coming from.
For cardiac electrophysiologist Dr. David Schwartzman, that understanding is ultimately the key to better outcomes.
Technology isn't enough. Skill isn't enough. We have all of that. It's about improving the quality of the lives we touch every day.
At Butler, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care. But more importantly, we know why we have to. Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
For so many of us, a loving pet is, well, it's a member of the family, isn't it? If you're looking for a veterinarian you can trust when it comes time for a checkup or treatment for a pet that's ill, consider Suburban Animal Clinic and Dr. Dennis Damon, Route 8 south of Butler, 4 miles south of Butler, right at the intersection of Route 8 south and Thorncrest Drive. Dr. Damon treats small animals, dogs, cats, all small animals, and exotic pets too. If you have a question about illness, symptoms, shots, a checkup, if you need to talk to someone about concerns with an aging pet or a pet near the end of life, you can trust Dr. Dennis Damon. He loves animals. He's a pet owner himself. Dr. Dennis Damon, veterinarian at Suburban Animal Clinic. Hours by appointment only, Monday through Saturday. Credit cards are accepted, and he makes house calls, too. Dr. Dennis Damon, Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, 4 miles south of Butler at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. Phone 287-5289. Welcome back, folks. I tell you what, I could talk from now till tomorrow morning about the history of Saxonburg and this wonderful, wonderful book by Clifford Zink on the Roebling legacy. Believe me, I was just hitting the highlights as we were reviewing some of the stuff there. A couple of notes. We mentioned that John Roebling eventually went to New York, of course, tragically injured and died shortly thereafter. Fred Caesar, he became a U.S. citizen, though, right?
Yes, he did. He did. Well, he was in Butler County here. He went to the courthouse at Butler County, and on the 30th day of September of 1837, he became a U.S. citizen. The paperwork is in the courthouse.
You might not be aware. Folks that live in Saxonburg, immediately surrounding that, will know there's wonderful things in the museum on the outskirts of town in Roebling Park, including you have some of his early twisted wire rope, right?
We have a replica piece. In 2006, a company called Lewes & Company in Connecticut, they made a stainless steel replica of John's first successful wire rope. We have an example, a replica of it, in the Saxonburg Museum that you can look at, and it was made in commemoration of his 200th birthday, and we have they cut it in lengths, and we've got a limited number of editions, and we have number 62 in the series in the museum, and people can come view it at the Saxonburg Museum. We're open Thursday through Sunday, 1 to 4.
I've been there. It's a wonderful place.
Thank you.
One final question for you, Clifford. Is it still the original wire on the Brooklyn Bridge, or have they replaced it in the intervening decades?
Well, the wire that is in the big cables, that is the original wire.
Amazing. Amazing, isn't it?
Suspender ropes. The suspender ropes that hang down from the cables and hold up the deck, those have been replaced.
Wow. Clifford Zink, who's been chatting with us on the telephone today, and we much appreciate that, the author of The Roebling Legacy. This book, copies of this book, will be available for purchase Clifford will be the keynote speaker at a reception dinner on Saturday evening, and he'll also be willing to sign copies of the book, which is truly wonderful. A review of the stuff that's going to happen a week from tomorrow, next Saturday, Fred Caesar. Parade in the morning in Saxonburg?
That's right, 10:30. Then we'll switch it over to an afternoon street party mingle from 11:30 to 3. And then the evening reception and dinner starts at 5 o'clock.
So relaxed. You can spend a full day there with the family.
You can be there. You
the
can...
parade. The Saxonburg mingles are great. You've been having those for a couple of years
now. Yeah, we get hundreds and hundreds of people on Thursday nights, the third Thursday of every month. And this will be another example of that, and it'll be a great time for everybody. It is a family event. The parade will be a family event. I think everybody will enjoy it. And the afternoon should be a great opportunity to just mix with a lot of people. And you'll get to meet some German from Mohausen, mm-hmm. and you might have a chance to shake hands with Kristen Roebling and also Clifford Zink.
And you can walk a block or so down the street to the Roebling Park on the edge of Saxonburg. The workshop's still there.
Yes, the workshop's there. You can have take selfies. People take selfies with the workshop. There is a replica of the Brooklyn Bridge there that's between that and the Park Pavilion and the gazebo that you can come enjoy.
Folks, this is real and amazing. It's a huge replica. I think they built it for a float or something.
They did a float for a parade, and then they decided to turn it into the replica that they put on the in the Roebling Park.
Is that the original workshop, by the way, where Roebling actually worked? It's not a reconstruction?
It's not a reconstruction, and we will have it open for that Saturday. It was originally at Water and Rebecca Street and then moved into the park to be preserved, and we have fixed up the inside. You can come inside and see the original walls, the mud clay straw walls, some of the original wood timber, and it is remarkable. We've had some people in there recently, even a gentleman that came from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, that worked for U.S. Steel. Mm. He was in town 2 weeks ago for the Lernerville event, and we opened it up and let him see it while he was there. And then there was a woman visit the museum last week. She was from Brooklyn, New York, and she was visiting friends, and she was amazed, and she was taking pictures to send to her family and friends in Brooklyn to say, hey, look at where I am.
So practice up on your German, folks. You can say Guten Morgen to the visitors from Mohausen. And on top of all this stuff we've mentioned, Saxonburg is just a beautiful, beautiful town to visit and walk through. And there have been a lot of improvements on the main street, too,
That's
in recent
correct.
Years.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Clifford Zink. It was a pleasure to meet you. Your book is terrific. And it's hard to say this about a book, but for yours it's true. This is a beautiful book. It's not only heavily researched, educational. It is a beautiful book. Thanks for being with us, Clifford.
Well, thanks for your kind words, Dave.
Sure, and we'll look forward to welcoming you again to Saxonburg a week from tomorrow. Fred Caesar, you know, when I first met you, it was a year and a half ago, I was hoping I'd have a chance to talk to you again, because you're a treasure trove of information about Saxonburg. It was good to see you.
Good to see you again, Dave. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Sure. Coming up, well, that's going to be the end of our program today. We're cutting it short by a couple of minutes because of a commitment to Pirate baseball. The Pirates are on a roll. They're in Chicago, and you know they play those afternoon games at Wrigley Field. So stick around. Pirate baseball coming up in just a couple of minutes on the Pirate Radio Network here on WISR 680 in Butler. Enjoy the weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 0909. The pick 3, 175, 175. The pick 4, 8912, and the pick 5, 96967. The wild ball for each of those is 6. Your treasure hunt, 1, 4, 7, 10, and 19. $10,000 estimated jackpot for tomorrow.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
I was just 49 when I started getting mail from AARP. AARP? Shoot, I was just getting started in life. Then I hit my 60s and retirement was on my mind. The big question was, did I prepare? What about healthcare? Are my finances in order? Not just for my wife and me, but for the kids and grandkids. I got the answers I needed from attorney Michael Pater, specializing in elder law, long-term care, Medicaid, and wills and estate planning, is attorney Michael Pater in the Handicap Accessible Morgan Center. Phone 287-7724.
We've got Pittsburgh Pirate Baseball coming up next here on WISR 680 AM. The Pirates are in Chicago to take on the Cubs. Current temperature 79 degrees.
Have Coffee with Kate and Dave Malarkey. Weekday mornings at 8 on WISR 680 AM Butler.